What is it that you do for ISL?
Well, as I said just now, I convene, which is sort of the coordinator or the person who buses people around to get the right strategy, the right directions in place for developing the terminology and the moving towards this naming of materials and compounds and so on. The terminology is really so that things can be defined so that everybody understands them. It has a definition associated with each term. And the terminology framework we've got is a taxonomic terminology. In other words, it's a hierarchical terminology, starting off with, if you like, with materials, and then nanomaterials, and then particulate nanomaterials, and what we call, by and large, we call nanostructured materials, or supra-nanostructured materials. And it's in that context that we are trying to help to make sure that everybody, when they say something, talks of the same thing. We're trying to do it in a lexicon, in the words that are meaningful, not just to a bunch of scientists, because they really don't need this. They can talk to each other, and even if they don't agree, they know what they're talking about. But it's really to make sure that people in industry, that people in government, and particularly the general public, can understand what's being said. Some of the stuff in biotechnology that people talked about, you know, recombinant DNA, this is something we should write. I have no idea what recombinant DNA is, and I'm a scientist. You know, transgenic material, genetically modified organisms. What on earth is that? This is not useful. We're trying to come up with a lexicon, at least at the high levels, that people can understand. So that's what I do. I coordinate that group, which involves typically about 40 different countries sitting around the table. Usually we have somewhere like one or two members from each country, so we're dealing with a group of 60 to 80 people, and we sit down and we discuss what other people have done, which are little subgroups of this, and they sit down and define bits and pieces of this, and then we fit it together when we all get together at the technical committee meetings. So long answer to a short question, but...
Well, you're dealing with developing standards for nanotechnology. What is it that's different about the way you're developing these ISO standards for nanotechnology from, say, other materials or products?
Yeah, that's the very fundamental question, and it's not just what ISO is doing. It's there is agreement around the world that this time on nanotechnology, because nanotechnology is going to be so pervasive in the industrial economy of the world, not just North America, in the industrial economy of the world, that we need to make sure that the need to be clear, the need to be secure, and the need to manage risk in this has to be as good as we can get. We need to put in place a transparent activity so that the general public, so that industries, so that governments, so that the scientists are comfortable that these aspects are being managed. This is not some magic thing that we don't know about. We know what we know, and we know what we don't know, but we can manage the risk. We're not asking the general public to trust us, because that's the last thing that we would want them to do, just because we said, well, we're scientists, you can trust us, because then one mistake and they won't trust us. We have to do it in a way that implicates them in some way or another. So, and we have to do this because there's no existing products out there. And we know that when we do develop, and as we've been discussing at this meeting, nanotechnology products from forestry, they are going to find an application in all sorts of industrial sectors, from the electronics, obviously from paper, certainly from coatings, varnishes, certainly from structural applications. It's a vast, vast world. None of those applications have been defined. We don't even know precisely what the samples of nanocrystalline cellulose look like, for example. So we've got to be able to write this down in a meaningful way before we actually get too far.
But how can you do that for things that don't exist? Is this more of a preemptive or political way of dealing with nanotechnology?
No, what we can do is we can write down what we call the high-level terms, the core terms. We can define what nanoscale is. This is between approximately 1 nanometer and 100 nanometers. That's what nanoscale is. We can define that. We can define nanotechnology. It's the It's the characteristics and functionality related to things at the nanoscale, and so on. So we can talk about nanomaterials. We can say nanomaterials contain facets. Either they are nanoscale or they contain things at a nanoscale. We can define these, and that begins to put in place the terminology framework in which we can stick. Now, nanocrystalline cellulose is a supranano structured material. It comes out in films, it comes out in powders, but they're big pieces. Okay, so we've already got the core terms that we can begin to define those. Now, somebody will have to go into the detailed terminology around that. So that has to come. When we talk about some of the functionalities, that will come. But at least we've got the core framework, and we all agree on the core framework. And when I say all, we have international support for the core framework. And when nations begin to explore writing regulations, they will use that core terminology framework so that we're all talking about the same thing. Now, they don't go too deep down into the terminology until these products exist, but at least we know the general areas they are going to come out in.
You mentioned in your talk that one of the reasons for trying to set up standards ahead of time is that you want to avoid sort of the negative aspects that came out of the development of bioengineered products or biotechnology.
Yeah, well, this is a comment that various governments have made to us, that they got into trouble with things like genetically modified organisms and so on. And in large measure, that's because we hadn't begun to look at the risk associated with this. We hadn't got an understanding out in the public of these. And in many of us believe that's, in fact, slowed down the development of biotechnology in a major way. Biotechnology is an incredibly exciting field. It has incredible potential. But because various nations have started writing regulations, we don't want genetically modified organisms, what on earth are they talking about? There are risks associated with this. We had to look at risk management. Risk management is a very, very careful activity of being responsible. You don't do things more quickly than you can deal with your uncertainties. Now, in nanotechnology, it is a challenge, but we do have people. There were several people at the meeting today from the risk management group. In biotechnology, we didn't do that early enough. And so people got worried, and reasonably so. If we don't know what we're talking about and people tell us it's dangerous, why should we trust anybody? And so what we want to do is to make sure this is open. We want to make sure the firms understand this. We want to make sure the firms use language that the general public can understand. And we want to make sure the consumer is linked in some way, that general citizens have got the language that they can understand it, so they can't say, well, I don't know, I don't like that. We want them to say, well, I do know, and I know it's going to be good for us, but I still need some more understanding. Who do I talk to? That's the sort of thing we're trying to get ahead of, just to allay this fear that technology is going to change their lives. You've all seen the grey goo story of Michael Crichton. This is when a self-replicating system got away from itself. Is that possible? Probably not. But we have a lot of self-replicating systems out there now. They're called people. They're called trees, they're called rabbits, and so on. They are all self-replicating, so we shouldn't be frightened of this. We do need to understand them. And that's what we need to be careful of in nanotechnology. And that's what we weren't as careful as we should have been, perhaps, in biotechnology.
What is the usefulness of having these standards? In your presentation, you put up a slide that showed a motorcycle, and there was something like over 500 ISO standards that applied to just that one vehicle. How might that be turned into the kinds of standards that we would see with nanotechnology, nanomaterials?
The transportation sector, vehicles, that's an industrial sector. We're not going to have the same thing in nanotechnology. I do not see there being a nanotechnology industrial sector. But as I said, I think there were 567 ISO standards related to motor vehicles. They related to safety, they related to windscreens, they related to various things, seating and everything, tires and so on. A large number of these are related to materials. And we will modify those standards because we will bring in nanomaterials to make the performance better. We're already doing it. In fact, the automobile is the biggest user of nanotechnology in industrial sector at this point in time, albeit it's rather sick at this point in time, but there's nanotechnology in the coatings. The varnish, the top varnish, it's much more scratch resistant, it's much less changed by the photolysis by the sun. The tires nearly all got nanoparticulate graphite in to make them better tires, and so on and so on and so on. There's many, many aspects of nanotechnology already in automobiles. So you have to write down how these things are going into the existing materials, again, so that everybody works together. Everybody has to provide a tire that's conformed to the standards so that they're safe and they perform in a way that everybody expects. And so when I have a box, a big box, and it says we have this tire and it conforms to ISO standard so and so and so and so, we know just because it conforms to that what we can expect from that box. We don't have to open the box to sort of test it out because it's standard. So we know what size it is, we know what its width is, we know what it's made of, we know what its period of the year when it's useful, we know whether it's going to be winter or not, and so on and so on and so on. These are all covered by standards. So when I as a consumer go and buy something, I don't have to worry about going to measure, is that going to fit on my car? Well, let me get my tape measure out. I know because there's a code on the side, and that code is a standard ISO code. It's as simple as that. Same thing with nanotechnology. When I get a box of nanocrystalline cellulose, which is going to be the cosmetic of the day, it will have, I trust, an ISO standard on it, and that will tell me what it is. So I know what it is, I know it's safe, and so on and so on and so on. That's what the ISO standards are for. And you need lots of them for something as complex as an automobile, an aircraft, you can imagine.
How is nanotechnology going to impact economic activity? How big is this?
You've got to be careful in terms of all the statistics out there. There are terms that up until the recent crash, I would have trillions of dollars. Well, I know what trillions of dollars are now. I didn't until we had this recent crash. But there's numbers like by 2015, 2016, roughly $3 to $5 trillion of the industrial sector in the world will be affected by nanotechnology. Now, you've got to be careful with those numbers because what they are saying is, well, it's not really the whole thing. It's not a nano automobile. It's going to have nanotechnology, nanomaterials in the tire, nanomaterials in the varnishes, as I said, the coating. So it has a nanotechnology component. And the intention is that we would say that was a competitive advantage. That was something that added value. So we're looking at added value to an element of the economy that is in the multi-trillion dollars. The numbers are, they're all speculative. 10 to 30% of the world's industrial production will involve nanotechnology over the next 20 years. When you go beyond that, it's going to be bigger than that. But that doesn't mean the amount of actual nanomaterials, the value of those nanomaterials in that, is going to be a very small fraction of that. But nonetheless, they are going to be a significant value-added component of that big piece of the economy. There will be a number of jobs involved. You have to know something about nanotechnology to get that. You have to have those nanotechnology components in there, otherwise you're going to have a competitive disadvantage in selling your car. The cars, and I don't know how true this is today, but the E-series of Mercedes and the 5-series of BMW, the varnish coating was in fact nanotechnological. And if you actually went out, and this is about 3-4 years ago I went out and did this, so I don't know whether it's true today, if you went out and saw one that was about a year old and you parked it next to one that was 2 or 3 years old, you could actually tell the difference. Wow, this is much brighter. Look, it's cleaner and it's not scratched. And that's not because it's newer, it's because it's got a better varnish coating on. And it's that sort of thing.
You've described your job of sitting down and trying to work out these definitions and these standards as boring but necessary. Why do you do it?
Yeah, well, I said that sitting down, arguing about the words is a boring but absolutely essential thing. I didn't say I did that. I just sit there and beat up on the people who do it to say, come on, hurry on, and get the right terms out there. But to be honest, to be non-trivial about this, this is an incredibly important element of the development of the economy of nations. It's particularly true for Canada. It's particularly true for Alberta. It's particularly true for Quebec, Ontario too. So this is something we've got to make sure we're there. We must make sure our industries get as much pre-warning of this, are involved in this, so that we don't lose economic activity. And it's a very, very important thing for this economy. If 30% of the industrial economy of Canada is affected by this, and the best guess is it's going to be at least that over the next two or three decades, we must be there. If we don't, somebody else will write the standards. So on the one hand, you can say it's a good altruistic thing of trying to do well for the world. A more realistic thing is that we're trying to make sure that Canada's well positioned. We've got the right partnerships in place to benefit Canadian economy. And we're making sure the standards, in fact, don't disbenefit Canada.
Thank you very much, Clive.
You're very welcome.